I'm really excited about this series we're beginning today, Knock Off. And, you know, one of the things we're going to be looking at throughout this series is this idea that, you know, there are many things in the earthly realm that are actually mirrored in the transcendent realm. And we're going to look at how, you know, there's many things in the heavenly realm, many of the things that God experiences that he actually mirrors in the earthly experience. We actually experience the character of God in certain ways in the earthly life. And today, we're going to be taking a look at whether or not we really have the real version or whether we have a knockoff. Now, I don't know if you've ever wondered why there are certain things in life you experience, and they just inspire you. I mean, they just kind of connect with you at a deeper level. Leonard Bernstein, who's arguably one of the greatest musical composers of this day and who's also an agnostic, he says, you know, in those moments when I hear like Beethoven's Fifth, he said, there's something that just stirs in me and almost brings me to the point where I believe perhaps there is a God. I don't know about you. For me, Beethoven's Fifth doesn't really do it. You know, Leonard Skinner, Freebird, you know, if I leave here tomorrow. What? Like, listen, if I were sitting in your seat, I would be bawling right there. I'd be like, ooh. You know, I mean, there's just something about 13 of the best minutes, the long version, Leonard Skinner, Freebird, 13 of the best minutes you will ever experience right there. You know, there's something about, you know, when something is done well, it just inspires us. And when it comes to marriage, you know, there's something about marriage. When we see marriage done well, there's something inspiring about it. I'll never forget this older couple that was the very first church I served at. He was one of the former pastors of this church that I was at. And in the hallway my office was in, they had portraits of all the past senior pastors. And so he's like 85, 88 years old at this time. And he and his wife are getting up there in years. You know, the joints aren't working quite the way they used to. And they would walk into, the eyes weren't either. They would walk into the this hallway, and I'd run into him every weekend, and I'd see him, and they'd be going down looking at all the portraits. And then they'd get to his portrait, and his wife would be like, oh, you are so handsome. It was just kind of beautiful to see. And I'd walk out and I'd say to him, I'd say, Hillary, it's great to see you this morning. He'd be like, young man, he'd come right up on my face. Young man, I tell you, it's great to see you as well. I just don't know who you are. And it was the funniest because then I'd see them driving through the community and I'm like, this dude can't see me when I'm standing 2 feet from him. You know, how does he drive? And yet, you know, there was this beautiful, beautiful picture that came out of their lives. I don't know how many years they'd been married, but I'd watch them walk down that hallway as they exited the church building. And they go out into the parking lot and they would walk arm in arm, joints, you know, kind of struggle a bit, hand in hand, leaning into one another at the age of 80, 85, 90. And I thought, what a beautiful, beautiful picture of marriage, of leaning in, of still, you know, 50, 60 years later, said, we're still leaning on one another. And it makes me kind of emotional just to remember what that looked like. And I mean, there are certain things. I mean, why does that kind of commitment move us? I mean, your marriage is something that regardless of, you know, every corner of the globe, it doesn't matter what time period you look at, you know, through every culture, you know, marriage is something that's embedded in the hearts of people. I mean, there's something inspiring about it. You know, this idea of a man and a woman together forever, you know, forever and ever. And there are variances of that in certain cultures, you know. And yet, you know, it's also very contentious, if you haven't noticed that. I mean, well, you know, the whole gay marriage thing, I mean, should they marry, should they not? You know, people that are divorced, should they get remarried or not? You know, there's a great deal of contentiousness when it comes to marriage. I mean, we don't get contentious like that about cornhole. No, it should be 26 feet, not 24 feet. I mean, we don't get that way. But for some reason, when it comes to marriage, let me say it again, a man and a woman coming together for the rest of their lives in every time period, in every culture, in every corner of the world, we're inspired by this. Why is that? I really believe it's because God has created us in his image. We are divine image bearers. And there's something planted inside of us that just is inspired when we see that. And you know, one of the things we're going to be looking at through this series is, you know, these eternal realities. Where are these mirrored in our world? And one of the things we begin to realize is when we're not mirroring these in our lives, then we're actually often settling for the knockoff. So I want to explore what that looks like for marriage today. And in fact, on my wrist, I have two versions of a Rolex watch. One is a knockoff. One is the real deal. One costs $5,000, $6,000. One costs $50. Any idea which the real one is? Take a look. You're going to vote? It's like American Idol. All right, how many of you would say this one is the real deal right here? Let me just see your hands. All right. How many of you would say this one is the real deal? A few more hands. All right, well, let's take a look and see. Ooh, scared me saying it. Yeah, this is the knockoff. All right, just That is the drill. That is the knockoff, right? This one's the real deal. And what we're going to be doing through these next 4 weeks is we're actually going to be saying, you know, where... So, the owner of this watch was gasping right at the moment, which is not me. We're going to be saying, you know, where in my life is the real deal happening, and where is the knockoff happening? How do we eliminate, how do we destroy the knockoff version? And so we're going to be looking at this today. We're going to be looking at what this looks like, how we experience this. And listen, we see this all throughout our culture. In fact, you know, in marriages throughout our culture, we experience this. People are like, man, if I just had my soulmate, if I could just find my soulmate, you know, that person makes me happy and that, you know, I was meant to be with. Listen, I don't believe personally there's a soulmate. I don't. I believe I could have married any number of women that would have taken me. You know, Julie had all kinds of options. I had few. And so, you know, but I don't believe there was one person I could have spent the rest of my life with. I just don't believe in the idea of a soulmate. In fact, there's a celebrity who really epitomized this and stated this very eloquently right before he got married. Here's what he said of his soulmate. He said, I didn't realize something was missing until my future wife came along and I just went, huh? How could I not know that I'd been missing this all my life? Can you think about this kind of person you'd like to be with, but then when it suddenly happens, it's in a way that you just didn't expect. I felt, oh my God, this is actually happening to me. I knew almost as soon as I met her, I'm going to be with this woman. So apparently he's one of the lucky ones that actually found his soulmate. Who is this person's soulmate? Anybody have any idea who this is? Tom Cruise and Katie Holmes, yeah, who are not married, by the way, anymore, you know. And in fact, in that article, he talked about, you know, my first two wives weren't really my soulmate. And listen, this is, I'm not trying to crack on Tom Cruise, even though it's kind of fun to do so. But what I am trying to say is Tom Cruise really kind of embodies, he epitomizes this idea of what many of us think about when it comes to marriage. This idea that, you know, marriage is good only when I find the right one, and if I'm in the one right now that's not the right one, I need to find the one that's the right one, and I need to find the perfect one that totally satisfies me. And listen, this is not God's intention for marriage. This is one of those places where God's relationship with us mirrors our earthly relationships with the person we wed. And, you know, two people in a marriage, again, two people relationally committed to one another forever and ever. And as we think about a relationship with our Heavenly Father, we're talking about a God who is in relationship with us through Jesus and who relationally and completely weds us, completely commits himself to us. And let me just give you a few examples. I mean, there's all kinds of these throughout the scriptures. Here's one from Isaiah. This is a picture of God, how he weds us, if you will. The commitment level is equal, or you're trying to mirror the intimacy and the connection that happens between a husband and a wife. Isaiah 62, as a bridegroom rejoices over the bride, so shall your God rejoice over you. This is really cool because there's going to be something in here for everybody today. If you're married, there's going to be something in here for you today. If you have a relationship with Jesus or you're pursuing a relationship with Jesus, there's going to be something in here today. Because what this is saying right here is just like a groom stands at the end of the aisle, and when his bride appears and she begins to come toward him, he just goes, ooh. I mean, he's just so overwhelmed. And what this is saying is, When the bridegroom, when God sees any of us moving toward him, he just rejoices. He's just like, oh, it's beautiful. Here's one I deeply long to know and be in relationship with, just coming toward me. Here's another one, Matthew chapter 22. And this one's interesting because the little context here. Jesus is being asked, you know, what about people who divorce and then remarry? You know, who's going to be married in heaven, you know, if they've had more than one spouse? Or what happens if somebody gets hit by a car, or in that day, like a camel, you know, comes flying by and takes somebody out, and their spouse decides to remarry? Who's married to whom when we get to heaven? And here's how Jesus answers them. He says, you're wrong. I love this. Lovey-dovey Jesus, you know, always kind of nice. He's like, you're wrong. You're wrong. You're wrong because you neither know the scriptures nor the power of God. For in the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are like angels in heaven. And so he basically says in the resurrection, there's this, and this is a really deep, deep connection. He's talking about way, way, way at the end of time when the earth, as we know it, comes to an end and there's the resurrection. He says, you know, there's going to be no need for marriage. The idea of marriage, it's done and gone with. It doesn't exist anymore. You're now with God just like the angels are right now with God. And so he paints this picture and he basically says, you know, marriage is a temporary institution that lasts as long as this earthly, you know, our earthly existence lasts, and it's meant to mirror how God is always relationally committed to us. Here's another one, Book of Revelation, chapter 19. Let us rejoice and exalt and give him the glory, for the marriage of the Lamb, key word there, has come, and the bride has made herself ready. Now, the word lamb is capitalized there because the lamb refers to Jesus. And so what this means is, you know, the marriage of the lamb to his bride, to those who have received from God, who have received grace through Jesus, anyone who has relationship with Jesus, he's basically saying he is wedded to. It's wedded represents this intense commitment to one another. Now, you know, I came to know Jesus when I was 14. Somebody received Jesus into my life. And you know, when that happened, I began to, you know, dive into the scriptures a little more. I started getting involved in a Bible study. There's something inside of me that just wanted, I believe God kind of all of a sudden gives us this want to try to understand more. And I grew through that period of time. When I went to college, I studied, you know, took some Bible classes, but I also accepted a call to ministry during that time. And I began a ministry degree, but I also just pursued a sociology degree. So I have tons of marriage and family classes, sociology, how people interact, institutions, the whole deal. And yeah, I never learned this then. See, my view of a marriage, even at that point, was a knockoff marriage. It was this idea that, you know, marriage is primarily so, you know, we can have children and, you know, we can have somebody so we don't die alone. And I have somebody I can kind of be close to, and but it wasn't until somebody really pointed out, said, "You know, man, it's meant to be so much more. In fact, it's a reflection of the kind of relationship that mirrors the relationship we have with God, our Father. It's an earthly realm relationship that mirrors a heavenly, transcendent relationship." See, marriage is actually a replica of how God has committed to us. I mean, this changes the paradigm for us right here. I mean, God is relationally committed to us. Think about this. There's no spirituality. You can, you know, some of the runaway bestsellers like Rhonda Byrne's A Secret. There's no personality in The Secret that comes after you that's relationally committed to you. You know, Eckhart Tolle, you know, The New Earth. I mean, you know, he talks about the ego, suppressing the ego. I think that's what he was talking about. I didn't quite get it all. But there's no personality that comes towards you and pursues you. One more, Ezekiel chapter 16. "When I passed by you again and saw you, behold, you were at the age for love. And I spread the corner of my garment over you and covered your nakedness. I made my vow to you and entered into a covenant with you, declares the Lord God, and you became mine." I mean, I love the tenderness right here. I love the tenderness. I love the sexual intimacy that's being communicated in this and talking about, hey, I saw you and I loved you and I love you so much. I actually covered you. I actually took care of you and I made this covenant with you. We entered into a covenant, and when we did, you were now mine. See, a great marriage is when you are your spouse's and your spouse is yours. Right? When you're kind of inextricably linked together, there's just this incredible oneness between the two of you. Tim Keller, who is a pastor out in Manhattan, you know, every now and then someone would be like, "Man, Kurt, whatever you said in this moment, man, that really impacted me." And I'll often go like, "Yeah, most of the great things you hear from me, I heard from somebody else." Right? Nothing originates usually with me. I mean, every now and then maybe. But Tim Keller is one of those guys who, through his writing and some of the reading I've done, I mean, he's really shaped some of my views, and along with a number of other people. But Tim Keller, you know, is somebody that Google does something really fascinating. Google, the corporation, actually invites people into their business to give talks, they're called Google Talks, with their employees on topics that otherwise their employees wouldn't necessarily dabble into. And they believe it kind of helps stretch them and grow them. And so Tim Keller actually got invited in. He's a pastor in Manhattan, got invited into Google to give the Christian perspective on marriage. I thought it was really fascinating that actually happened at Google. And I could tell you about what he said. I mean, some really cool things. Instead of me telling you about it, I want you to take a look at a short scene from that talk.
I can't tell you how often I've actually heard people say this. I've heard people say it one way or another in movies, television shows, or in person. They say, "I love you. Why do I need a piece of paper to tell you I love you?" The piece of paper, the marriage thing. It's legal. It's not the essence of marriage. The essence of marriage, in that view, is passion and feeling. That's the essence of marriage. Not contracts and legal things. On the contrary, the Christian view of marriage is that the essence of marriage is a long-term binding commitment epitomized in a covenant or a legal contract. A long-term binding commitment is the essence of marriage, not the passion and feeling, because that comes and goes and comes and then goes and then comes. The thing that actually is the essence of marriage is that long-term binding commitment through a covenant. And here's the reasons why that's so important. And I know this is counterintuitive to contemporary people. First of all, the legal covenant actually makes marriage more intimate, not less. You know, there's two basic kinds of relationships. I'm going to call them consumer and covenant. A consumer relationship is like the relationship you have with your local grocer. You have a relationship with the grocer as long as the grocer is giving you produce at good produce at a good cost. But if you find somebody who gives you much better produce at a much better cost, you're going to go to the other grocer. Why? Because your individual needs are more important than the relationship. In a consumer-vendor relationship, your needs are more important than the relationship. In a covenant relationship, let's give you another example, parent-child. You're raising a child, the child cries, the child's selfish, the child's ill-behaved, and you can't say, I've had it, like you can with a grocer, and just leave the child on somebody else's doorstep. You'll go to jail. And the reason is, at least our understanding is, your relationship with your child is not a consumer-vendor relationship, it's a covenant relationship. Now, when you're dating somebody or seeing somebody or having a relationship with somebody, a romantic relationship, but you're not married, you know the other person could walk away anytime. And therefore, you're essentially in a consumer relationship in spite of all the rhetoric. In other words, you're still basically in marketing and promoting yourself. You have to. You've got to literally put your best face on because that other person could walk. But when you get married and when you say, I'm bound to you through thick and thin, and when you have that legal contract, it creates a cradle of security for your vulnerability. It makes it possible to say, here's who I am and here's what's wrong. It makes it possible for you to actually be more intimate, more yourself, just a piece of paper.
That's interesting. You know, so many times we think about a marriage, you're coming to make vows, you come to an altar, and it's not about saying, here's what I believe right now. It's actually a futuristic thing. You know, Julie, she's been married to at least 3 different men, you know, over the course of our 17 years, all right? She's only been married to me physically, but I've been 3 different people, at least over the course of those, and she didn't know I was saying that, by the way, over the course of those 17 years that we've been together. And you know, this relationship is one that says, hey, you know, even as I change, even as you grow, even as you morph, I'm still all in. I'm still here with you. And you know, that one of the things that happens in a knockoff marriage is as we change or we grow, or maybe, you know, the married relationship ebbs and flows, and all of a sudden we're like, you know, it's not what I thought it was. It's a knockoff. It's a knockoff. You know, one of the things I love about Crosspoint is that, you know, people come in here from varying backgrounds and spiritual perspectives, life perspectives. I love that, love that. I love that, you know, we have a lot of people that come into this place that are living together, that are trying to figure out what this idea of marriage is, or just who God is and how he pertains to my life. I love that. I love that people come into this place and, you know, can be living together and have a place to explore. I love that. I mean, that's one of the beauties of Crosspoint. And yet I love at the same time that when people come into here, we can actually really dig through heavy stuff and be open to new realities and things that may kind of push against us. And so I want to push for a little bit against those of us who maybe feel like, you know, there's really not a difference between living together and marriage, you know, commitments. I want to push on that a little bit. You know, I do weddings quite frequently, actually. I'm getting into the heavy weddy season, summertime. It's funny, whenever you get to the vow section of a ceremony, it's kind of the harrowing part of the ceremony, right? And, you know, it's funny because, you know, sometimes you have these long vows and the bride and groom are just crazy nervous, you know, and so you just keep breaking the vow down shorter and shorter so they can remember it. And eventually it's kind of like this. It's like, I, take, you, John, two. Yeah, you know, it's almost like it loses the significance of it. But I thought about this thing about vows. I thought, you know, what would a vow look like if we made vows, you know, when we moved in with one another? What would that look like? And I kind of got a jump start on this from an article called Not a Fan, difference between being a fan of Jesus and follower of Jesus, and kind of adapted a few of these to reflect this. Here's kind of a humorous look at this. I, John, take you, Mary. This is what vows would look like when we move in if we were to make them. I, John, take you, Mary, to be my cohabitant, to have sex with and to share bills with as prearranged upon. I'll be around while things are good, but I'm open to leaving if things get tough. If you should get a cold, I'll run to the drugstore for NyQuil. If you should get sick to the point where you can no longer meet my needs, then I retain the right to move on. Forsaking old boyfriends and girlfriends, I'll be more or less faithful to you as long as it feels good to me. I commit to live with you as long as this works out. If we should break up, I will always say that our time together was special. Now, while funny, many marriages today, what I've been discovering is many marriages, these were your vows. These were your vows. Even at the altar, even at that moment where you made vows. You know, it's more like this is a utilitarian relationship. It's helpful. It meets my needs for a time. And when it comes to an end, or there's another vendor who provides a little better service, well, then I just kind of move on. And see, this is not the ultimate beautiful thing that God gives to us in terms of this mirroring of the relationship he has with us. I mean, what he says is who we are right now, he commits to. He says, hey, you want to receive from me? You want my grace? You get it. He said, and as you change, as you ebb, as you grow, as you, you know, go this direction, he said, I'm there. He's like, I'm into you. See, numerous ways throughout the scriptures illustrate this love relationship between God and us that mirrors the relationship we have with a husband or a wife. And one of the craziest pictures of it comes in an Old Testament prophet, a guy by the name of Hosea. And he tells Hosea, hey, Hosea, go out and marry a prostitute. And here's what it says, actually, in the very words of the Bible. Hosea 1, and the Lord first spoke through Hosea. The Lord said to Hosea, go take yourself a wife of whoredom and have children of whoredom, for the land commits great whoredom for forsaking the Lord. Three times, what a word, whoredom. Gotta love the word whoredom. How many of you said whoredom this week? All right, I take that as a no. So lean to somebody next to you and just say whoredom. Just say it. Just say it. You're not calling them a whore. You're just saying the word. Right? Whoredom. Man, how often do you get to do that in church, right? That's good times right there, whoredom. Now, it's in the Bible. So, now, what this is saying right here, he's saying, Hosea, this is a big deal. I want you to do in the physical realm what I've been doing through eternity in the spiritual realm. That's what he's saying right here. I want you to take a person who's going to cheat on you. I want you to take a person who's not going to be faithful to you. And I want you to wed her because it's like I've wedded a bunch of whores. Now, I don't know if you've ever considered yourself a whore. All right? But you probably are. Believe it or not. I mean, I don't know if you ever thought about that, but you probably are. In fact, there's one way to know. There's one way to figure it out. One way is very obvious. If you've ever, and I'm talking about the spiritual realm here, not the physical realm now, all right? Let's talk spiritually, the spiritual realm. If you've ever done something you knew God didn't like and you chose to do it anyway because you knew he'd forgive you, you're a whore. I mean, if you've ever come to a point where you're like, I know this is what God wants me to do, but I'm going to do this instead. Or I know God doesn't want me to do this, but I'm going to do it anyway. And you have a relationship with Jesus. You say, hey, I'm in Jesus. I want to follow you. I want to live for you the best I can. You're a whore. I mean, I have all kinds of whorish behaviors. I have all kinds of whorish behaviors. And the crazy offensive thing, if we can be really honest about this, is God sees this, and here's the crazy thing. God sees you and I do that, and you know what he says? He says, yeah, I'm still into you. I'm still here. I'm still relationally committed to you. I'm still all in. And yet, so many of our marriages don't mirror that kind of commitment. I mean, we see it as a consumer-vendor relationship. We're like, oh, you didn't make the bed 3 days in a row. You didn't fulfill your end of the deal. You know, we're always doing this. You know, I'm just glad I'm wedded to a God that's like I'm all in. I mean, I'm glad to be wedded to Julie too. I'm glad to be wedded to a God that isn't always, you know, I'm not always at that place where I'm like, oh, he's watching me to see if he's still going to be in with me or not. I mean, take a look at the first wedding, Adam and Eve in the book of Genesis. And we don't have weddings like this in America, but in Genesis, here's how it played out. It said, a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And it says they shall cleave. And when you cleave, you're in a specific land known as Cleveland. Now, funny story. We were at a Pacers-Cleveland game like 2.5-3 weeks ago. We were sitting like third row, which I never get a chance to do. It's through the generosity of some friends. And there was a guy in the second row yelling at Byron Scott, the coach of Cleveland. He's like, dude, you get to go to Cleveland tonight. What kind of life is that? You're going back to Cleveland. This Cleveland, I think, is pretty good right here. So he said, you know, Cleveland. Now, and so what he's saying, and here's what's happened. Now, listen. Some of you are going to be like, this is really rude, Kurt. This is disgusting. I can't believe you're saying this. Listen, this is the real deal. I'm giving you real stuff right here, all right? See, men have been created with a unique part. Women have been created with a unique area. And basically an area that gives and receives. And what this is saying right here, what this scripture is saying, is it's very clear. When a man gives and a woman receives, he says that they are locked together in one flesh. And this actually mirrors the oneness that we have in a heavenly realm with God. It's a physical representation of one flesh that mirrors how God becomes one with us. See, this is why, you know, we claim to be lovers of Jesus and we live together as sex outside of the marriage context. This is why it's so offensive to God. Because, you see, God never, you know, God never mirrors something that he's not actually having in his character. He doesn't do that. When he says, hey, here's where I am, it actually mirrors who he is. He's always committed. He's always in. And he always publicly commits it. See, I've been sitting all morning on an altar, in case you didn't know that. There's an altar. Some of you think an altar is a very sacred thing nobody touches, or it's an area at the front of the church, or, you know, it's a place with a white tablecloth and a glass of wine and some bread. And, you know, those are like sanitary versions of an altar. We never do anything sanitary at Crosspoint, except with your kids. We do sanitary stuff there. But, you know, this is actually a very authentic representation of an altar right here. And an altar in the ancient world was where you came to make covenants. You made covenants on space like this. You would come to a place like this, and if somebody, you know, was committing their lives to one another in marriage, they'd come right here and they'd be like, I'm all in. This right here is a reflection that I'm all in. And so, you know, there was something sacred that happened here. And they would always, at the end of that covenant, they would kill an animal and let the blood drip off the altar. And there would actually be a fire under here. And this was actually a reminder that, man, this is a very sacred, sacred moment right here. And that's why you oftentimes see Jesus referred to as the Lamb. We looked at one passage this morning. He's known as the Lamb. Because, see, Jesus' death on a cross, which was actually an altar, was the thing that signifies where he said, hey, I'm declaring publicly, I'm all in with you. And you're actually free because of what I give you. He publicly declared it. Look at the book of Colossians. It teases it out this way. It says, and you who were dead in your trespasses, God made alive together with him, having forgiven us all our trespasses by canceling the record of debt that stood against us with its legal demands. This he set aside, nailing it to the cross. This is nailing it to the cross. I mean, see, in ancient cultures, if you were in debt to someone, you would actually have to go to a debtor's prison to work off that debt. Or you'd have to go to the person who held the note, and you would work for them until you worked off the debt. And once you would work that off, they would actually develop a certificate and take that into the town community hall, and they would nail it on a bulletin board saying, Kurt Walters is no longer in debt. Kurt Walters is free. And so what this is saying is that you and I, we're all in debt because we're whores. And maybe some of us haven't figured that out yet. I'm not sure I am. You're probably just a prideful whore, all right? So, you know, you're just not in tune with reality yet. And what this is saying is, you know, when God, all the debt we were accruing, that he's saying, when I brought Jesus and laid him on the altar and put him on the cross, I put all of the sin you'd accrued on the back of that lamb, and that lamb went to the altar for you. And now you're out of debt. You're forgiven. It's done. It's gone. No more. You have to do anything to pay for your indiscretions. It's done. And this is one of the things that makes knockoff marriage so, so difficult. See, somebody makes a mistake, and it's kind of like, oh, you got to work that off. Oh, man, I got to make sure the room's picked up because I left it 5 days in a row, not that way. Or, man, I lost the right to have a voice in this situation because I really screwed up right here. Say, no, that's normal. I know that's somewhat normal behavior. That's a knockoff. See, the expensive beauty of marriage is when you say, no, it's done. It's done. You've sought forgiveness. You've screwed up. You knew that you could get forgiveness. And yet at the same time, I'm all in. That's a very expensive marriage right there. It's a very expensive marriage. And the Bible says, as far as the east is from the west is how I view your sin. And I tell you what, when your marriage begins to look that way, look out, Loretta, man. You got a great marriage coming right there when your marriage begins to live in an all-in covenant relationship instead of a contract vendor. See, unless we capture the transcendent nature of our marriages and realize these mirror a relationship with our Heavenly Father, and we realize how expensive it costs to have a good marriage, we're going to be in a knockoff. So, some of you are like, where's the application? Here it is. 5 quick hitters for marriage improvement ideas, all right? 5 quick hitters. First, pursue a common vision. Maybe you have a vision statement for your marriage, maybe a mission statement. You know, if you're into that stuff, that's great. This needs to be on a micro level. What are you do together? you know, for Julie and I, we've had a lot of things over the years. I mean, we used to mountain bike together. That we were kind of into that for a while. We'd go out on trails every night after work. We used to camp together. That was kind of our common vision. We used to ski, and, you know, any free time in the winter, we'd be skiing together. It was a common thing we did that created common experience. We, you know, we thought we'd try a dog and make that our common vision. Didn't work so well, so we went to kids. Made that our common vision. We're much better at the kids than the dogs. You know, Crosspoint was a common vision. This wasn't just me. I'm the one on set, but this was us saying together, we're committed to this common vision. Getting out of debt. Getting out of debt for a 3-year period of time. We worked together. It was a common vision we had for our family. You need to figure out what, if you don't know what it is, what are we together on? And then you need to work that out and do something about that. Create that common vision. Number two. Schedule sacred meeting times. What is your date rhythm? What's your date night? These are moments that are sacred. When's that time where you have sacred time together? And listen, this is mirrored in our relationship with God as well. I mean, nowhere in the Bible does it say you must enter an auditorium with sound speakers and listen to the word one time a week in an auditorium, you know, for 70 minutes. You know, but what I can tell you is, you know, if you don't have sacred meeting time with God, the one thing I can say is I can guarantee you your relationship with God is probably on a spiral downhill. If you don't have a relationship, if you don't have that sacred meeting time. For Julie and I, this happens about 9:30 at night. After the kids are all down, right now, over the last months, it's happened in our bedroom, on our bed. That's where we kind of meet together. And some of you are like, man, I like that kind of sacred meeting time. That's good. Not that. That's a different time. This is where, now that it's getting nice out, it happens on our patio, all right? And we gather at the patio. We'll go outside after the kids are down, have something to drink, and I'll say, hey, Julie, how was your day? She'll be good. Good. You know, we'll talk about, you know, how was yours? Good. Good. Oh, great. Sometimes that's all it is. You know, and I'm like, man, I'm tired. Or she'll say, I'm tired. I need to go into bed. And that's it. Sacred meeting time. But it opens the door for the moment where I'm like, hey, how was your day? And she's like, oh, man, I was really bummed out with this thing today. In fact, I can't get my mind off of it. And then we begin talking about it. Sacred meeting time. You need to find it. Number three, expose yourself. Expose yourself. See, Adam and Eve were naked. It says the man and the woman were naked, and it was okay. I build that into every marriage ceremony that I perform. I say, are you okay if I say naked in your ceremony? Because it's going to happen. All right? It's important to understand. You got to expose yourself. Emotionally expose yourself. Intellectually, your hopes, your dreams, everything that you're thinking about aspiring to right now. Expose those things. I would even say physically expose yourself. And this is interesting because, you know, the older you get, those of us that have been married longer, you know, the sex life just gets a little harder, right? I mean, the passion isn't there quite as frequently as the hormones aren't raging all the time, and things are drooping a bit, and you know, you just don't find yourself buck naked as often as you used to, let's be honest, right? And I'm serious, this is really important, all right? This is very important. There's a level of vulnerability that's required when you're physically naked. Just like a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, I was standing there in the bathroom looking in the mirror, and I twisted like this. I'm like, right here, I noticed like a little, like looked like cottage cheese. I'm like, I'm in pretty good shape. Where'd that come from right there? What? And my natural tendency would be like, oh man, I better cover that up. Julie could never see that. And yet, no, we got to, you know, expose yourself. There's a vulnerability that happens when we do this. In fact, when we begin to carve things out of our life that we don't get vulnerable on and put them in the closet, nasty stuff begins to grow. Nasty. I mean, mold always grows in the dark when it stuff's in the closet. I mean, mold never grows in the light. You need to shed light on that stuff and be vulnerable. You need to figure out, where do you need to take a risk this week with your spouse emotionally, you know, physically, you know, relationally? Where do you just need to kind of bare yourself? Say, hey, here's what I'm thinking. Fourth one. Lose. This is a favorite one. You need to lose. You need to learn how to lose. See, every marriage that's 50-50 is a marriage that isn't working. Every marriage that's 50-50 is a marriage. That's a contract. You know, if you're like, man, I'll make the bed 50% of the time, you make the bed 50% of the time, or my 50% is to bring home the bacon, your 50% is to cook it. You know, whatever it is. I mean, that's a contract vendor relationship. That's not a covenant. And you know what happens in a relationship like this? We're always looking for if they're fulfilling the contract or not. Oh, are they doing their 50%? Oh, they're sliding a little bit right here. And as soon as you see them sliding because they're not fulfilling their end of the deal, you know what begins to happen? You withdraw. You withdraw. Take a step back, tiny little steps out of oneness. And this is not the way God intended it to be. And so, you know, God isn't looking at us to see if we're fulfilling our, you know, all the contract obligations that he gave. He's not like, oh, I wonder if Kurt's going to, you know, mess up right here and I'm going to pull out right here. I'm out. God doesn't do that. I mean, God looks down and he's like, oh, I'm all in. I mean, Kurt, he screws up. I'm all in on that. See, great marriages happen when two people learn to lose for one another. For Julie and I mean, you know, 10 years ago, we were buying a car, and the car Julie wanted was not the car I wanted, and it was the car she was going to be driving. And so, you know, if I would have fought for it, I would have pressed harder for a different car, but, you know, I'm like, I chose to lose right there. And I tell you what, it was one of the best cars we've ever had. I had it for 9 years. Kids had great experiences in that van. I mean, choosing to lose. Maybe you're figuring out where you're going on vacation this summer and you're not seeing eye to eye. Choose to lose on that. Or maybe you're in an argument and it's over like parenting philosophy. Just lose. Choose to lose. See, there are very, very rare moments where there's something that you're just like, you should be like, God, this is like a God thing where I've got to take a stand right here and die on this hill. I mean, let me say that again. There are very few of those moments when it comes to a marriage. Very few. In fact, I can't remember the last time Julie and I had one. See, the Bible says we need to be like Jesus. What did Jesus do? Jesus went to an altar and he lost. Jesus actually started as the Word in heaven. And he came down to earth, took on flesh, so he chose downward mobility. And then once here, he continued downward mobility to the altar, to the cross. And he laid down his life for his pals, just like men should lay their wives down for their spouses. To die for them. See, we lose. We mirror this transcendent reality. You need to figure out this week how to lose. One of the beautiful things about this is mirrored. I mean, what we're talking about marriage-wise is mirrored in our relationship with God. And for some of us this morning, we're just seeing this for the very first time. And maybe you're thinking, man, that's a God I'd like to be wedded to. I mean, a guy that is like, I'm just always looking over to see if I'm screwing up. But when I receive from him, I enter a covenant where he says, I will always be there. I will always remain faithful. In fact, that's something you can even do in these next moments. As the band, you know, plays this song, you know, in the quietness of this song, I mean, you can just choose to say, God, I want to receive from you this morning. I want to enter into a relationship with a God, into a covenant relationship with a God who will always be there, who will always be faithful. I want to do my best to follow you, but I'm going to screw up at times, but I know that you will still always be there. You're still going to be in with me. And that's the kind of relationship that can begin at any moment, in any context, in any place, including right now. God, when he hears those words from you, He acts on it right away, and that relationship begins. Let's pray. God, I'm thankful we can come into a place like this. I'm thankful that we can shatter paradigms. We have these shallow paradigms that just don't work, and we settle for the knockoff version in too many ways. God, it's expensive. Marriages are expensive. I mean, these four things, expensive losing, expensive sacred time, expensive risk, expensive common vision. God, these are all things you paid for as well. Paid for these for us. And so God, I'm just praying that a unique thing would happen with every marriage in this room this morning, that you would just maybe help us to go to that next place to get a little closer to your transcendent reality. God, I pray for every relationship that's trending toward marriage, the potential of marriage in this room today. You just do something unique today. God, I pray that you just clarify.